Today I will be speaking with Jared Diamond, author of the book Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. In his previous Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he analyzed the environmental factors that help some societies to gain technology faster than others. In this book, he studies why societies implode. Unrelated to the KPFT program of the same name, the Progressive Forum will bring Jared Diamond to Houston for a speech on the 24th of February. If the subject of this interview interests you, you may contact the Progressive Forum at progressiveforumhouston.org or call 713-315-2525. What factors correlate strongest with societies that are long-lived with ones that aren't?
That's a very interesting question to begin with, because it's one of the most complicated questions. In the book, I looked not only at societies that failed, but also at those that succeeded. And perhaps the two deepest lessons my study, in addition to a shallow one, were as follows. The shallow lesson is that, of course, societies facing the most difficult problems were most likely to collapse, societies living in deserts or in very cold areas. But for societies facing about equally difficult problems, the ones most likely to survive were the ones in which, first of all, the elite were exposed to the consequences of their actions, so the decision makers felt the consequences if they made a bad decision, and they were motivated to make good decisions, whereas societies that failed were likely to be ones where the elite, at least for a time, could insulate themselves from consequences of their actions. And then the other deep lesson is that societies that succeeded are ones that were willing to reappraise their beloved core values when conditions changed. And the failures tend to be ones that cling to core values even after they become inappropriate.
In many of the societies you studied, the societies with the strongest class or caste system or the most strongly entrenched elites reacted with less flexibility than more egalitarian societies.
That's exactly the case. In Maya society, the kings lived in royal palaces and they taxed the commoners. So even while the commoners were beginning to get malnourished, in fact starving from deforestation and soil erosion on the hillsides, the kings, who could perfectly well look out the windows of their palaces and see the deforestation and erosion, weren't affected by it because they were still getting well fed and they were getting luxury goods from the commoners, until it was too late and the commoners got so starving that they rose in revolt and overthrew the kings and burnt their palaces. So that was a case where the kings were short-sighted because they didn't have an incentive to be far-sighted. Whereas an opposite example is Japan in the Tokugawa era, that's about 400 years ago, there were military leaders of Japan called the shoguns who built themselves huge wooden castles at the same time when the common Japanese were moving into cities and building themselves wooden houses, but the cities tended to burn down, so they had to rebuild wooden cities, and that meant consumption of lots of wood. And the shoguns felt the consequences because with their needs for so much wood for castles, the shoguns began to find that they were having to send away to the northern end of Japan to get more wood. So the shoguns, unlike the Maya king, were motivated, and the shoguns then solved the wood problems of Japan by instituting wood rationing and having wood plantations put in to increase wood production.
The thesis of your previous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, was that the principal reason for the variation in technological growth between different cultures was environmental. Let me turn that around a bit and ask you, what environmental factors have the strongest effect on sustainability?
We need to be clear when we're talking about environment and climate what it is that we're looking at their effects on. In my first book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, there I was concerned with a question, why did societies on some continents become technologically more advanced and conquer other continents? In particular, why did Eurasians conquer Aboriginal Australians and Native Americans and Sub-Saharan Africans instead of, say, Aboriginal Australians coming and conquering Europe? And there, at the level of whole continents over the last 13,000 years, the answer clearly was the rise of agriculture. Because once you are producing food, you have a population explosion, you can feed lots of people, you got the food surpluses, feed the kings and the smiths and the inventors. So for Guns, Germs, and Steel, environment, particularly domesticable plants and animals were the answer. Then your second question about environment and sustainable lifestyles or sustainable agriculture. You could have a sustainable lifestyle in almost any habitat. For example, the Inuit operated more or less sustainably in the Arctic. Or the Pueblo Indians found a way to operate sustainably in the desert. And the New Guinea Highlanders found a way to operate sustainably in montane forest. So in almost any type of habitat, you can either find ways to mess up and ruin yourself by operating non-sustainably, or you can find ways to operate sustainably.
Early in the course of you writing the book, you use much of your research as part of your lectures at UCLA. Many of your students seem to be asking the same question over and over again, despite the fact they had the creativity to reword it slightly. How can people as smart as us, just like us, do something so obviously stupid? How could they do things that any rational person could see was a collective form of suicide?
That's right. Yeah, my students asked me that question several times. In our past, in our distant past, there's an example of where I think humans have been facing, in a way, the same problems for tens of thousands of years. There are examples of non-sustainable behaviors in societies 10,000 years ago. For example, 13,000 years ago, Native Americans, possibly the first Native Americans in the New World, were probably responsible for exterminating the elephants and the horses and the camels and the giant ground sloths of the New World. They were not operating sustainably, just as today most modern societies are not operating sustainably. Today, of course, we've got guns and bulldozers. Back in those days, they had bows and arrows and stone tools. But still, with bows and arrows and stone tools, you can gradually exterminate your prey animals. One example of it is, what did the Easter Islander who chopped down the last tree on that island say as he or she was chopping down the tree? This is an island whose society collapsed as a result of chopping down all their trees. And you might naively think that they'd look around and say, my God, this is really dumb. There's no way we're going to chop down that last tree. We're not that stupid. And yet they did it. It's a widespread problem. Today, we're also doing things which in 50 years ago will look very stupid. And so if there are still people 50 years from now, they'll look back at the world of 2006 and say, why on earth did those people not shape up and stop causing global warming? And why do they continue to over-harvest their fisheries and destroy the fisheries and trees on which they depended? Well, my students asked me that, and there are lots of reasons why people make mistakes. There are reasons why we make mistakes in our individual lives, why some of us make bad investments or marry the wrong person or take the wrong job. And similarly, there are reasons why societies make mistakes, even though you might say they ought to know that it's going to ruin them.
You made some predictions about our society's future later in the book. I was surprised by the limited role that peak oil had in your analysis. How does peak oil affect your view of our future?
It's true that I did not use the words peak oil in my text, although I referred to some of the references on peak oil in the further reading section. But I did have a chunk of the last chapter of my book in which I said that one of the 12 problems that we're wrestling with today is the energy problem, and that oil production has probably peaked, and that we are depleting at least cheap, environmentally benign sources of oil. It's not that we are running out of oil. There will still be oil 50 years from now, but it'll be deeper in the earth, more expensive to get out, and dirtier. And that's part of the peak oil story.
What caused the failure of the Viking settlement in North America?
They had misfortune, and they also made mistakes. Their misfortune was that the Vikings were at the end of their transport trail. The Vikings were trying to cross the North Atlantic in small, slow ships with small capacity. So Norway and Greenland really were not in a position to support colonies in North America, the way 500 years later England and France and Spain were in a position to support colonies in North America. So part of it is that the Vikings came at the wrong time. Second piece of it is that the Vikings made some very bad mistakes with Native Americans. They were greatly outnumbered in North America by Native Americans, and so their survival would depend upon being nice and setting up good trade relations with Native Americans. And instead, the first group of Native Americans that the Vikings saw, there were 10 of them, and the Vikings made the mistake of killing 9 of them, and then they made the further mistake of letting the 10th get away to go and complain to his friends. So, of course, the Native Americans came and attacked the Vikings. The Vikings should have set up nice, peaceful trade relations with Native Americans. That was a mistake.
What can we learn from the Anasazi today?
Lessons from the Anasazi are that if you're living in a very fragile environment like the desert, you better take really good care of it because climate is going to change. And a practical lesson is that the city of Tucson in the Arizona desert, where there used to be Anasazi, in the 1960s, Tucson went through a drought. Inhabitants of Tucson got really scared, and they said, we got to conserve water. We're not going to have golf courses. We're not going to irrigate our gardens with succulent vegetation. And so they got scared for a few years, and then the drought ended, and they forgot those lessons. And now, once again, they're building golf courses, and they're allowing lots of big developments, and they're letting people water their gardens. So inhabitants of Tucson ought to remember what happened to the Anasazi. If you're in the desert, and there's a drought once, there's going to be a drought again, and so you better be geared for a drought.
What can we learn from the people who lived on Easter Island?
A transparent lesson in Easter Island is don't chop down your last tree on which you depend. And another lesson is that a reason why they chopped down the last tree was that they were too busy fighting each other. The political leaders were too busy concentrating on winning the next election. On Easter Island, you won the next election as a chief by attracting prestige by putting up bigger and bigger statues. But if you focus only on the next election, that may get you elected, but it may get you elected into a society that you've ruined. And winning the next election is something that American politicians are very much too preoccupied with.
What about the people of modern Montana?
What can we learn from the people living in Montana? Wrestling with a whole batch of problems. Montana looks like a really pristine, underpopulated state. And yes, Montana has, I think, the lowest population density of the lower 48 states. And yes, Montana has a higher fraction of its land in forest than any of the lower 48. So you might think that Montana would have no problems, but you scratch the surface and Montana has problems of forests and fish and water and topsoil and air quality, salinization. And so if people in pristine, underpopulated Montana have those problems, then you better believe that people in Texas and California and Florida with lots more people and much less pristine are going to have those problems even worse.
Is there anything you feel that people should know about your book?
Well, what can I say about the book, since we've talked about collapsing societies, and that might make your listeners really depressed and ready to commit suicide, and certainly not buy the book. I'd also emphasize that the book is not depressing, but it's heartwarming, because it talks about societies that succeeded in solving their problems, and concludes that we too can solve our problems if we would learn from societies in the past. So get ready for some cautiously optimistic reading.
I have just been speaking with Jared Diamond, author of the book Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. Unrelated to the KPFT program of the same name, the Progressive Forum will bring Jared Diamond to Houston on the 24th of February. If the subject of this interview interests you, you may contact the Progressive Forum at progressiveforumhouston.org or call 713-315-2525. For The Monitor, I'm Byron Jackson.